Welcome to a special Thursday afternoon edition of The Grueling Truth. I'm your host, Mike Goodpaster, and as always, I want to welcome in my co-host, Matt Andrew Scavage.
Thanks, Mike. It's always great to be here, and it's an absolute privilege to be a part of the show we got today.
Well, hey, like I said, we got a special guest today. That's why we got a special time. Our guest today helped lead the University of Virginia to the first bowl game in school history. I think it was the 1984 Peach Bowl. Later went on to star with the Green Bay Packers, where he was named to the 1987 NFC Pro Bowl team. Help me welcome to the show former Packer great Don Majkowski.
Hey, guys. It's a pleasure to be with you today. Thanks for asking me.
Hey, it's great to have you. Like I said, you went to the University of Virginia. Kind of a twofold question. What made you want to go to the University of Virginia? Because they were known more back then as a basketball school. And maybe talk a little bit about your time there, the first bowl appearance in the 84 Peach Bowl. Just tell us a little bit about your college experience.
Yeah, it was kind of weird how I ended up at University of Virginia. I actually grew up in Buffalo, New York. And coming out of high school, I wasn't a very highly recruited quarterback out of high school. I was more known as a basketball player. I didn't even start my junior year in high school at quarterback, played defensive back. And then my senior year, my first game of the season where I was going to start at quarterback and it was going to be my big year to get recruited, I broke my passing hand in the first game of the season and I missed my entire senior year. So all the schools that recruited me, including Syracuse, which was very close outside of Buffalo, New York, which I really wanted to attend, they all recommended I go to this one-year postgraduate, it was a military prep school. And it was called Fort Union Military Academy, and it was about 35 minutes outside of Charlottesville, Virginia, and at the University of Virginia. So, you know, you had to be pretty much a Division I prospect to go to this prep school. So I went to the military prep school, had a great year there, went undefeated, and being so close to UVA, they obviously recruit Fort Union, and you know, I just ended up going to the University of Virginia. I wanted to go to a program that, you know, didn't have a real established starting quarterback at a young age. They had a fifth-year senior when I enrolled as a freshman. So I had the opportunity to compete for a starting job there as a sophomore, which I won a starting job and ended up being a starting quarterback there for 3 years, my sophomore, junior, senior year, and really was a part of turning that program around. Like you said, my first year starting there as a sophomore, we went 8-2-2, and I think we ended up number 13th in the country that year, ranked. And we went to the school's first bowl game ever in school's history. So, you know, being a part of school's history was really kind of a neat thing, and being part of really bringing the football, you know, program back into you know, a respectable program. And you know, it was great being a part of that. And you know, I had 3 great years there.
With the NFL draft coming up, John, we're always curious about what it's like for a player on draft day. Tell us a little bit about your draft day experience.
It was not a good one. Back when I got drafted, kind of the same thing happened to me. The same thing did happen to me my senior year in college as it did in high school my senior year. I got injured in the third game of my senior year of college. Was running the option, and I separated my shoulder and missed a lot of my senior year. So I was a projected probably first or second round pick coming out of college from Virginia that in 1987. I think I was in the top 5 quarterbacks. But after that, I sustained that shoulder injury, my draft status dropped, my stock dropped tremendously. And I remember back then in 1987, you know, they did the draft all in one day, and they had 12 rounds back then in 1987. They started at 8 a.m. in the morning on ESPN. And they did the first 6 rounds all the way until, I don't know, 6 p.m. And, you know, the rest of the draft went on all the way through the night until they finished. Well, I was in my apartment at University of Virginia all by myself, you know, starting at 8 a.m. I turned it on. I'm watching. And, you know, 4 quarterbacks my year got drafted in the first round. It was like Vinny Testaverde, Jim Harbaugh, Chris Miller, and then Kelly Stouffer. So I'm like, wow, 4 quarterbacks went in the first round. I was ranked like 5th. But actually, because of my injury, I didn't receive my call all the way until midnight that night, just sitting in my apartment by myself. And I remember, actually, I got a call from the Buffalo Bills in the 6th round. Bill Polian called me in the 6th round, they wanted to know if I wanted to come to Buffalo as a free safety, and I did not want to play free safety, so I declined, and you know, just told them I wanted to play quarterback, and I didn't get my call until midnight that night, and you know, the Green Bay Packers and Forrest Gregg called me and told me they drafted me, and you know, I was very bitter that I went that late, and but I also was just excited to go into camp and prove to them, you know, when I'm healthy, that they got an athlete and a quarterback that is much, much better than a 10th round draft pick.
All right, Premier, people remember you wearing number 7 for most of your career. When you got to Green Bay, you actually started out wearing number 5. How did you get number 5, and then later, what made you want to switch to number 7?
Yeah, you know, when I first went to Green Bay, you know, I wore number 1 in college all 4 years, and then when I got to Green Bay, you know, as a 10th round draft pick, the first day I went to training camp, I went, you know, you go into the equipment manager line, and you go to get your practice issued socks and shorts and shirt and everything. They call it a roll. And then I went in my locker and I saw number 5 hanging there. And I'm like, hey, do you guys have number 1 available? And they looked at me like it's a 10th round rookie, you know, like they don't ever give out number 1 Green Bay, first of all, but they looked at me like I had any say in the deal being a 10th round draft pick. They kind of laughed at me, but back then, you know, there was a different rule that they have now in the NFL. You know, they could bring in like 100, 110 guys in a training camp back then in the beginning of camp. So they had to issue out every possible number that was available. And I unfortunately got number 5. And, you know, I knew that was legendary Paul Hornung's number. And, you know, Paul Hornung was actually doing a lot of our preseason games on radio at that time. And my rookie year, I remember playing a lot and having Paul being, you know, he liked the way I play. You know, he was very, very positive in his comments on the radio. The way I played, and he said I reminded him a lot. I reminded him a lot of him, and that of himself. And that if they were going to give out, and if they're going to give anyone out his number, that they were glad that they gave me that number. You know, and I remember going up to him a couple times after the game, and I said, "Hey, Paul, I'm sorry they gave you my." He gave me your number, and, you know, I didn't want to wear it. And he said, hey, it's okay. I like the way you play. You know, you get the long blonde hair. You know, I was a golden boy. So there's some similarities. So he said, I'm glad they gave it to you. But, you know, I wore it my whole rookie year, you know, as you know. And then my second year, as I became more of an established starter, I had a little bit more say. And I changed to number 7, wanted to get my own identity as a player and as a Packer. And, you know, out of respect for Paul Hornung, did not want to wear his number 5 and wanted to put that on the shelf. So that's the reason that I changed numbers.
Tell us a little bit about what it was like playing for Coach Lindy Infante.
You know, Lindy was an unbelievable offensive-minded coach. You know, he came to us from Cleveland as the offensive coordinator, where he was coaching Bernie Kosar, and he was under you know, Marty Schottenheimer as the head coach. And when Lindy came to Green Bay, he really, really taught me how to become a professional quarterback and learn how to become what he termed, I needed to change from becoming from being a gunslinger to more of a manipulator. So he wanted to really teach me the finer points of quarterback and how to use your intelligence and become just more professional in that regard. So I give all my credit really to learning, you know, how to read defenses, learning how to do everything as a quarterback to Lindy Infante. And his play calling ability was phenomenal. You know, the great year I had in 1989 when I led the league in passing. I mean, his ability to, you know, to develop a game plan and to you know, watch all this game film and break down film and to put a game plan together and call plays at the exact time when he knew defenses would be in a certain defenses was remarkable. And, you know, at times his play calling was so good. It made it so easy for me because my first guy, he would predict exactly what defense they would be in, and we would have the perfect play call, the perfect pass called, And he really he made my job easy at times. Not all the time, but, I mean, a lot. He was a great play caller and did a great job of game planning. So, you know, I really enjoyed my 4 years at Lindy. And, he, like I said, he was responsible for really turning me into the consummate professional quarterback.
Yeah, he was a great coach. I know he was the Bengals' offense coordinator in 1981 and 82, and that was Kenny Anderson's best 2 years. Do you think Packer history remembers Infante unfairly?
I'm sorry, what was that last question?
Do you think that the history of the Packers fans remember Infante unfairly then?
Well, you know what? They really do, you know. And you know, unfortunately, I talked to him a lot about this. You know, Lindy, you know, really a big reason, you know, for his demise and our team's demise was, you know, in 1990, you know, the year after I was all pro, running his offense, leading the offense and leading the NFL in passing. The next year, unfortunately, my contract had expired and I had to sit out all training camp. We could not come to agreement on a contract renegotiation. And, you know, Lindy didn't have a starting quarterback in all camp going into 90. And then finally, when I did sign, you know, I mean, you know, several games, get back into, you know, midseason form. And that's the year I had the unfortunate injury. I tore the rotator cuff in my passing shoulder, my right shoulder. And, you know, it was a major, major injury. And when I came back, it never was the same as before, you know, the injury. And my arm never recovered to the full strength as it was. And I never mentioned that, you know, but – you know, Lindy had to deal with that. He didn't have a quarterback that was as healthy and was as good as he was prior. So, and it had a lot to do with his unfortunate record at the time. And you know, and I don't think Lindy was also he was in Green Bay as a head coach at a time when management was very reluctant to spend money and get the best players around to be successful. And it was right after, you know, unfortunately, Lindy got fired in 91 when they brought in Ron Wolf and Mike Holmgren, and they got a new general manager, and they also they got a new chief negotiator, that they started spending money and they started winning. But during my time with Lindy there, it was very, very difficult, and he had to do the best with a bunch of marginal athletes that were there.
Now, 1989 was really your signature season. Talk a little bit about what that season was like for you personally and some of those big games, those amazing comebacks that you had, were a part of.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, 1989 was, you know, my first full year as a starter from the beginning of the season. And it was my third year in the league. And like I said, it was the second year under Lindy Infante's system. So we were really starting to understand his philosophy and his offensive concepts, which were, they were pretty difficult. And, you know, it took a full year to understand that. So by the second year, as a team, we were understanding that, and we were executing a lot better the system that he had in place. And I knew myself, I was a lot better. I had dedicated the off season in between 88 and 89 season to really trying to change my throwing motion, quickly my release, and I spent hours and endless hours of watching film of different quarterbacks, mainly Dan Marino, and the way he managed the game and his quick release, and just tried to emulate and copy a little bit of his throwing motion. And of course, I don't think anybody can throw like Dan, but I definitely needed to shorten my throwing motion. So, you know, that was a big positive change that I did in the off season between 88 and 89. And, you know, having all those really close come from behind victories in 89 was a magical year, no pun intended, you know, and it really brought back the excitement to Packer Nation, where after so many down years and average years in the 80s and the mid 80s, that we finally brought back some excitement and some respectability to Packer football. And, you know, the Packer fans really appreciated that. And to this day, you know, when I go back, they're just so thankful that we brought back that excitement that year and we gave them something to cheer about after having so many down years. So it was a very proud year for me. And, you know, we had some great victories. I mean, we had a lot of comebacks behind victories. We beat the Bears for the first time that year. in Green Bay at Lambeau Field. It's a pretty memorable game. It was called the instant replay game, where they had to review it for 4 minutes, the last touchdown pass that threw in the game, and we beat the Bears by 1 point, which we hadn't beaten them for eight games in 4 years. And, you know, we beat San Francisco in San Francisco that year. Just had, I don't know, four or five one-point victories that we came from behind that were some amazing games. So it was, without question, my most memorable year of my career, and it was a great team year. It was a great year for our team as well.
You talked a little bit about the 1989 Chicago Bears games called the instant replay game. I've seen a lot of conversations with Mike Singletary and Mike Ditka. They still claim to this day you were over the line. I actually watched the play today. I still think it was a touchdown, but maybe that's because I didn't like the Bears. But do you ever run into Coach Ditka or any other Bears fans that bring that game up?
Bears fans all the time. I mean, yeah, to this day, you know, if I'm in Chicago, if I run across Bears fans, they're always, you know, screaming to me, I was over the line, you know, whatever. But, you know, Coach Ditka, you know, they did a special on that this year on ESPN, on NFL Countdown this year with Chris Berman and everything. They did a special on that game, and they had me on there explaining the whole game. They had Singletary on there, and they had Ditka at the end. And, you know, I told Ditka, you know, after all these years, I mean, they finally got it right, and he needs to let it go. And, you know, how they do the come on, man type thing. On Monday Night Football, I told him, Dicker, come on, man, you got to let this thing go, you know. he's still, and his response to it, he's still very aggravated by it, you can see, and said it was the wrong call. If it was in Chicago, that call never would have happened. But that was, it was the right call. I mean, and not just because it was me involved in it, but I think they got the right call. And, you know, again, it was just one of those it became one of the most memorable games in Lambeau Field, and especially between the Bears and the Packers.
Now, you got to play with a lot of great players, especially guys like Barry Sanders, Sterling Sharp, even Tim Harris, and you know, Herman Moore. Tell us about some of your favorite memories with your teammates, and if you got any stories, we'd love to hear it.
Wow. I mean, where do I start? I mean, you know, especially in Green Bay. I mean, I had so many – in Green Bay, you know, when I played there for my 6 years, that was a really special place. I don't think there was any team that I played for. You know, I played for the Colts after I left Green Bay for 2 years, and I played for the Detroit Lions. But there was no team that had the close relationships as friends and as teammates as the Green Bay – as we did in Green Bay. Just a smaller community at that time. A lot of the guys spent so much time together in the off season that we developed a special bond, you know, friendship, and as teammates. So, you know, a lot of the great memories were, you know, in the off season. Just we had a Green Bay Packer basketball team where we traveled around the state, played in charity basketball games, you know, and you know, a lot of memories led back into the season, of course, too. But just being such a tight-knit family, we spent holidays over everybody's house. After every game, all the guys and either their wives or girlfriends and family members came up my house after every game. It was like no other team that I played on. So those are my best memories from being in Green Bay, you know. But, you know, playing from other teams, I did play with some great players. You know, when I went to Indianapolis, I got to play with Marshall Faulk, who was in his rookie year, was a great running back. And then in Detroit, like you said, playing with Barry Sanders and Herman Moore. Herman and I, you know, both went to the University of Virginia. We had a left tackle, Ray Roberts, who went to the University of Virginia. So a lot of times when I was playing, there was three Virginia alumni playing at the same time, which was really cool. It was a great 10 years. You know, it was just unfortunate that I had that shoulder injury in 90 that really limited me from being a consistent starter at the Pro Bowl level that like I was in 89 for the rest of my career. The only thing that I really regret.
Yeah, I think a lot of people forget how good you were in 89. I think you threw 27 touchdown passes, over 4,000 yards. I think a lot of that gets forgotten. The only time you got to play in a playoff game, I believe, was with Detroit in 95. I believe he came in the second half of one of the highest scoring playoff games ever against Philadelphia. I know the outcome wasn't what you and your teammates were hoping for, but can you tell us what that playoff experience was like for you?
Yeah, you know, it was, you're right. It was the first playoff game that I ever was on, you know, during my 10-year career. It was in my ninth year as a backup quarterback in Detroit for Scott Mitchell. And you could just tell that once you got to the playoffs, it was just a different, it was such a different, exciting atmosphere than the regular season. You know, it just was a special time, a special part of the season. And unfortunately, yeah, we didn't play well at all. I came in relief for Mitchell. He had a really, you know, dismal game that game and came in the second half. When we were way behind, and I still came in. I think I threw three touchdowns and, I don't know, an interception or two. But just playing in that playoff game was pretty neat. But I would love to have been able to have that opportunity when we were in Green Bay, especially in 89 when we just missed the playoffs after being 10-6 that year. Because it's different than the regular season. Very exciting.
Now, eventually in 1996, you actually got to return to Lambeau to play against your former team. What was that like?
Yeah, that was very strange as well. You know, I was playing for Detroit, and again, Scott Mitchell was injured that week, and I had to play. I was a starting quarterback going into Green Bay that week. And, you know, that was the year that the Packers ended up winning the Super Bowl in 96-97 season. And they were incredibly strong on defense. So I was having some major ankle issues at that time in 96. And I was playing injured, if could be, on my left ankle. And really went into the game and, you know, did the best we could. But, you know, we got dominated by the Packers. And, you know, we got beat up pretty bad, but it was kind of weird, you know, being in the opposing team's locker room and coming out. We were playing for a different team. It was odd, but, you know, a lot of guys do it, and you have to get, you know, get used to it, but it was definitely strange.
Now, you talk about the 1989 season, magical, ended up badly. I think you guys ended up, if I remember right, I was a Bengals fan. The Bengals played the Vikings that night. And I remember I think they were cutting to the, it might have even been your house where you had a party or something. Could you talk a little bit about
actually,
what
it was actually it was actually at one of my teammates' houses, Brian Noble, our linebacker. Yeah, it was a Monday night football game. And Monday night sent a crew to really get the reaction of, you know, we had a lot of our teammates at this at Noble's house watching the game, and they just wanted to get a reaction, some of our comments in between in between the quarters and so forth. And unfortunately, like you said, yeah, the Bengals, I guess the Bengals had to win in order for us to make playoffs, and they lost to the Vikings, and the Vikings went on even though they had the same record as we did. But that was tough to handle, because I think we won our last five of our six games that year in 89. We really were on a roll, and you know, we would have liked to have had an opportunity to see what we could have done in the playoffs. I think we would have done well.
All right. For all the listeners in, we got about 6 minutes left in the live show. The last 15 minutes will be archived. At the top of the hour, around 3 o'clock, you can listen to the rest of the show. So I can tell you this. Also, as a Bengals fan, that game still bothers me, too, because we had to win that game to get into the playoffs also. So that was a bad night for both of us, probably a lot worse for you than me since you were playing. But I'm sure Matt has a question ready.
Yeah, you know, as you watch the game today and you watch quarterbacks and the way the game has changed over time, what are some things that you notice about today's game, and who do you really enjoy watching?
Yeah, today's game, you know, it just gets more complex, you know, from the years that I played. I think defenses and their philosophy and their schemes have gotten a lot more complex, that quarterbacks just have a lot more on their plate, have a lot more to dissect and understand, and how to read defenses and all the different zone blitzes they have now, and all the different things that defenses are doing. So it's interesting to see, though, how quarterbacks coming out of college these days also are just much more prepared to handle the NFL game, and they're a lot more knowledgeable. They're running a lot more pro-style systems in college. So guys are coming out, you know, running the spread offense, and they're reading defense, and they have a lot more experience of reading defense in college. They're a lot more prepared to handle the NFL and professional schemes, like I said, early in their career as rookies and then in their second year. And that's probably the biggest change. And some of the guys who I enjoy, I mean, obviously, you know, I'm still a guy who likes guys who can sit in the pocket and throw but also have some mobility as a quarterback. But, you know, all the top guys, you know, like Brady, Drew Brees, Manning, obviously Aaron Rodgers, in my opinion, is the best quarterback right now in the NFL, and that's not just because he's a Packer. Aaron has developed into a quarterback that has everything that a quarterback needs. I mean, he has unbelievable knowledge of the game. He has the ability to throw in the pocket. He has the ability to throw on the run. He's got great mobility in the pocket. He's got great feet. And his release is quick, and it's the quickest release ever, I think even quicker than Marino. And the ability to throw from any angle, anywhere on the field, it's just it's second to none. I mean, the guy is really taken to the next level. So I love the way Aaron Rodgers has developed into a quarterback. I love the way he changes his mechanics, because I remember having a conversation with him early in his career. I mean, his rookie year, he had awful mechanics. I mean, before he threw the ball, he held the ball up near the ear hole of his helmet, you know, and was dropped back holding a ball by his ear. And I even told him, and I know all the coaches did, that you got to bring it down to chest level and move the ball from armpit to armpit, become more fluid. And he's done a great job of that. And proud of what he's done and the quarterback he's become. So, you know, I enjoy watching him the most out of any quarterback, to be honest with you, in the NFL.
All right, we have a caller on the line. I'm going to welcome in. Welcome, caller. What's your name and question for Don Majkowski? Hello? Caller? All right, I guess the caller doesn't have a question. But you were talking a little bit about players today and the way the game is today. What's your take on players like Borland from San Francisco and everything that are, you know, worried about the head injuries or retire at an early age?
Well, you know, it's just an individual case basis. You know, everybody has his own individual situation and his own reasons for playing and for not playing. Has his own motivation for playing and for not playing. So it's a case by case scenario. You know, and I respect everybody's, you know, opinion. Guys wanting to retire early and not wanting to potentially, you know, suffer some of the head trauma and some of the long sustaining injuries that are a result of all the, you know, concussions. I understand that, but you know, it's about where it is. It's a case by case basis, and I respect everybody's individual opinion and you know, what they feel about that situation.
How do you feel about the way instant replay is now? I mean, they had instant replay back when you were playing, and it went away for a while, and they brought it back, and they seem to tweak it every year. What are your thoughts on the way they do it now?
Yeah, I think it's necessary without question. And you know, I was involved in a lot of important plays in my career. A couple, you know, especially in '89, there were two games that were it was instrumental to have instant replay and getting the correct call, because all the referees, you know, there's that room for human error. And I just think no matter what the situation is, that you have to have the ability to go back and check out each individual play and get the correct call. And it's unfortunate, though, even, you know, as we saw last year, I think in the Detroit Lions and Dallas Cowboy game, that they, even with the use of instant replay, they don't get the call right. You know, I mean, there's that interference call late in the game where the Detroit Lion guy was, I think he was blatantly interfered with, and they did not get the correct call, even though looking at it, it was instant replay. So, but generally they do get it right. And I just think that I'm all for instant replay. And I think they do it a lot quicker than they do back when I play. So, you know, I'm an advocate for it.
Well, another question about today's game. I know player safety is a huge thing with the NFL, and the thing that really bothers me about that is the fact that, you know, you had the Sunday night games, the Monday night games, and the Thursday night games, I think, are kind of contradictory to having the players, you know, health. It's more
right,
about a money
right.
thing. What are your thoughts on that?
No question. You know, having teams having to play on Thursday night nowadays, which was not in place back when I played, that's a tough deal. If you play on a Sunday and then you have to play again on a Thursday night, that especially if you're a player that's, you know, in his mid-30s, you know, a 7 or 8 year, 9 year veteran, or could be even in his mid-30s, upper 30s, it takes a full week to recover from a Sunday's game, and having to come back and play on a Thursday would be extremely difficult when you get in your upper, you know, you get a little bit older in your career. You know, I know they're getting more games in. It's making it more exciting for the fans, but it's very difficult for a player. I would not have been in favor of having to play on Thursday night games, especially after a Sunday game. I mean, I can easily recall that it would take me until really Friday to start feeling better and getting all the soreness out of a Sunday game sometimes, especially later in my career. So it makes it difficult. And, you know, I just hope they don't go to an 18-game schedule. I know they've been playing with that idea, but that would be even more difficult for players to avoid a lot of injuries with a longer season as well.
Are there any players that are coming out of college that you've got a pretty good prospect in today's NFL?
Well, you know, I watch a lot of the young guys coming out of college, and I evaluate a lot of the young quarterbacks, especially. And there's some prospects that you just never know. I mean, you never know. I mean, you know, a lot of these young quarterbacks who are getting drafted in the first round, you never know what type of professionals they're going to, you know, turn out to be. I mean, you look at, you know, Johnny Manziel, for instance, last year. I mean, you know, taking him in the first round was a huge risk, not for off-the-field purposes, but just, you know, the way he played in college was not a transition into the NFL. The things that you see some of these college guys do in college that you just cannot do in the NFL, just because NFL is just too good. So I'm interested to see this year how, you know, Marcus Mariota and Jameis Winston are gonna adjust to the NFL. I've got a lot of I'm a lot more skeptical on some of these guys. I don't see them as being necessarily, you know, guaranteed first round picks. I see a lot of flaws in both of their games that they'll need work on going into the NFL, and especially Jameis Winston. I just think he's so slow footed. He does not have the quick twitch mobility or quick twitch pocket presence. He's very sluggish in the pocket, and I think he's going to be a sitting duck for the NFL pass rush, and it's going to be very difficult for him to be as successful as he was in Florida State. It's going to be a big change. So it'll be interesting to see how they adapt and make adjustments as they get into the NFL.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, when you look at these guys, I don't think any of them are worth a top 10 pick, maybe a late first-round pick for Mariota. But a lot of these guys, it's going to be dependent on really on where they're drafted, who their coach is going to be, and what's put around them, and how quickly they're supposed to succeed. I mean, a guy I like a little bit is Brett Hundley. What do you think of Brett Hundley?
No, I do like him as well, you know, and I don't think he had the supporting cast in college at UCLA that a lot of these other college guys did, obviously, like Winston did in Florida State. I mean, he had, you know, an NFL team around him offensively, you know, and made him having success a lot easier than a guy like Brett Hundley. I really like Brett Hundley a lot. I think he's got some great athleticism. He throws the ball well. He's got a quick release. He's got good mobility. And it'll be interesting to see. I think he's a guy that could have a lot more success than even the top two guys right now coming out in the draft.
You know, you'd mentioned mechanics and slow-footedness for Jameis Winston. What kind of you'd mentioned that even in your own development when you'd come in the league. How hard is it to improve those mechanics? And, you know, how long does it take for, like, an average quarterback to develop into even just a good quarterback on average?
Well, you know, there's things that, you know, guys like Jameis Winston and Marcus Mariota will need to improve on as soon as they get to the NFL. And a lot of that is, you know, these guys aren't used to taking snaps from under center. They're going to have to get a lot more comfortable taking a snap from under center and dropping back. I still watch both of them in their pro days, and they're doing all these game-changer programs and, you know, quarterback coaching camps with John Gruden and Steve Mariucci. I watch all these things. And they have mechanics that definitely need to be worked on and changed and fixed for the better. And it can happen, obviously. I mean, I know for myself, like I said, I had a very elongated throwing motion coming out of college in my first 2 years, and I changed my throwing motion and really learned how to throw properly. So these guys will improve with their quarterback coaches, their individual quarterback coaches in the pros. They need to learn how to use the proper shuffling motion when they're in the pocket, especially Jameis. He just crosses his feet and he's very slow footed in the pocket. He needs to learn how to keep his feet shoulder width and just shuffle within the pocket without crossing his feet, you know, when he's stepping up or going side to side. And what both of them also do, if you watch Mariota and Jameis Winston, when they throw their ball, both of them lock their left knee out. Now, as a quarterback, you have to, when you follow through, you have to transfer your weight from right to left, and you have to have your left knee slightly bent. Both of those guys lock their knee out in their throwing motion, which forces them to throw more all arm instead of using their upper body and more of their trunk and more of a rotational throw. So I know I'm getting pretty specific here, but there's some mechanics that need to be changed, and it can be fixed. So, I mean, it can be fixed within their first year. And like I said, Aaron Rodgers had that, problem with dropping back, keeping the ball too high against his ear, and there was some simple adjustments that can be taught.
All right, I've been a private quarterback coach for a while. Coach a bunch of guys that are in college, high school, even junior high. If you could give any advice to a young quarterback coming up, what would be the first thing you would tell them?
As a quarterback, the most important thing you have to have as a quarterback is you have to have leadership skills, and you have to have that confidence and that just natural aura about yourself that you really can't teach. And really it comes from leading by example, and you have to just be who you are, and you can't try to be a leader and try to be someone that you are not, because your players will see right through that. So you need to lead by example, and you need to gain the respect of your teammates as a quarterback in order for them to follow you as their leader. And once you earn their respect, and that's by leading by example, showing them how hard you work in the off season, work at practice, and the confidence that you have in yourself, treating them fairly, treating them as teammates that you love and that you'll do anything for. Once they buy into you, then you can lead them anywhere. So one of the most important things that I tell quarterbacks, you have to learn how to become a leader. You have to learn how to become authoritative and just be able to not be a shy quarterback. You can't worry about having fear of failure. You have to, not dwell on mistakes, and just having that natural confidence in your leadership abilities is what I tell guys is really most important about playing quarterback.
Now, I know you're moving on to a more of a personal note. I know you got two kids. You named your son, I believe, Bo Cannon Mikowski.
Correct.
And you were coaching him for a while. And your daughter Danny's also very athletic. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing now and what you're doing with your family.
Yeah, my daughter Danielle is 18 now. She's a senior in high school. She's getting ready to graduate and attend the University of Georgia. She was a four-year starter in basketball and soccer, was a star in both sports, so very athletic. And very intelligent academically. Got a full scholarship at Georgia, which he'll be attending next year. And my son Bo, he's a sophomore right now, and he loved playing football. He plays baseball. He started on varsity in both sports as a sophomore. Will be the starting quarterback next year at Johns Creek High School here in Atlanta, Georgia. as a junior and starts in the outfield, center field, right field in baseball, also as a sophomore in varsity. So throws righty, bats lefty, and has a good arm. And his middle name, Cannon, is he's got a cannon. So it's gonna be fun. You know, I coached him all through little league since he was 8 years old, all the way through until he got to high school, taught him the quarterback position. You know, I coached him in football, obviously. And was just some years that were some of the best years of my life. It was a lot of fun being that close to him and going through all that experience. And you know, I hopefully wish him the best. He's got a chance to, you know, to hopefully continue his career in college somewhere, in either baseball or football. So hopefully
that
things will turn out.
We got about 2 minutes left. So my final final question is: what's next for you personally? Any plans to write a book or do more broadcasting or any other endeavors you want to talk about?
Writing a book could be something possible, and getting into broadcasting might also be something possible. But right now, you know, I've been so involved, wrapped up with my kids' sports that I've pretty much been retired for the last 3 years. And just been a full-time dad, you know, involved in my kids' high school sports. And hopefully we'll continue to do that with, you know, my son for the next couple of years in high school and hopefully in college. So nothing on the plate professionally for me right away. Just kind of enjoying what I have here as a professional dad and my family, to be honest.
Hey, we really appreciate you calling in today. You were one of my favorite quarterbacks, late 80s. Loved that 89 season. Really appreciate you calling in, though, and we would love to have you back anytime.
All right, Mike and Matt. My pleasure. Always enjoy talking with you, Matt, and give your best to my father, to your father. And
will do.
Thanks for having me, guys. Yeah, we'd love
thanks
to be
so
on
much
again.
Thanks so much for stopping by. We really appreciate it.
You got it, guys. Anytime.
Yep, thanks again, Don.
Okay. Take care.
All right, remember, next Tuesday night we'll have our first boxing show. My co-host will be Joe Rodriguez, because Matt don't know nothing about boxing. He just with them 49ers.
I freely admit it.
Next Wednesday we will have a special 2 o'clock edition Eastern Time with former Ohio State quarterback Cornelius Green. He was a 1974 Rose Bowl MVP. And next Thursday night we'll be back at our normal time at 11 o'clock with Todd Stussy, to preview his app for the NFL draft and to preview the draft in of itself. You got any final words, Matt?
Well, I'm looking forward to talking to Todd Stussy again and getting into this draft app. But I really enjoyed talking to Don again about his career. He's always got a lot of stories. Always a good time.
Yeah, the bad thing with him is people forget exactly how good he was when he was healthy.
That's right.
So we will see you next Tuesday night at 11 o'clock Eastern Time for former heavyweight champion Tim Witherspoon. Until then, have a great weekend.